Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
With each episode of the Future of Everything podcast, we get out of the newsroom and go meet the scientists, engineers, and entrepreneurs who are designing the way our world is going to work. It takes us a lot of places. So far, since we launched, 17 states, more than 40 cities, 3 countries, and counting. This episode, a look back at 2017, our first year, and some of our favorite moments.
This is the Future of Everything. A look ahead from the Wall Street Journal.
From the newsroom in New York, I'm Jennifer Strong, and this is the Future of Everything. From asteroid mining to brain implants, cryptocurrency to 3D printed kidney tissue, nothing is off limits here. In season one, we meet the college freshman who built the first fingerprint reading smart gun, learn how high-tech veggies can be engineered to bleed like a burger, and we check out real leather that grows without any cows. I learned quickly on this trip that when an executive in this space talks about outdated technological platforms, what he means is a cow.
These organisms have a metabolism, and so this is like a human being laying here. It's respirating oxygen, giving off CO2. This will grow for about another 24 hours, then it goes in the fridge and we put it in stasis.
What makes this meat alternative? The animal is still walking around.
Now these cells came from a duck that's still living its life.
When Iron Man and Captain America battle it out, you know, those are two good guys fighting. And, you know, the microbiome actually can follow some of those analogies.
Scientists with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration are boarding a military jet in Florida. They're called Hurricane Hunters. This particular flight flew into the eye of Hurricane Maria to release experimental drones called coyotes.
You hear a sound? That's the chute opening.
The company says it's growing new kinds of polymers, or plastics, from the roots of mushrooms. It sounds friendlier than saying fungi.
And my field is in the area of synthetic biology, where we are re-engineering the genetic code that underpins life to address a wide range of biomedical applications.
We're seeing boxes get much, much more tightly packed together because now a lot of facilities have robots moving the boxes around instead of humans, so the robots don't need quite as much room to maneuver.
What might that mean in a warehouse fire? One way to find out is to start one.
30 seconds until ignition.
One of our most popular episodes from season one takes a closer look at asteroid mining and the Outer Space Treaty. It's called Law and Order in the Final Frontier.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
What if, going forward, rocket science is the easy part for the space industry? From moon hotels to colonies on Mars, companies hoping to profit from outer space all face the same question. Is it legal? The final frontier is starting to look a lot like the Wild West. Growing numbers of private businesses have fortune-seeking schemes, but many of their plans remain in something of a legal gray area. Everything that happens in space falls under an international agreement called the Outer Space Treaty, but it marked its 50th birthday this year, and it's safe to say a few things have changed. Space reporter Adam Mann takes us on a field trip.
Starting?
Yep.
To the Chabot Space and Science Center outside of San Francisco.
We are looking at a pretty ordinary looking rock, the only difference being somebody brought this rock back from the moon. Specifically, this was a rock that was picked up on the Apollo 15 mission. So the reason why this is actually interesting and relevant is because this rock, which was brought back by American astronauts, is currently U.S. property. This is property of the federal government, as are all of the other moon rocks that the Apollo astronauts brought back, which included hundreds of kilograms of rocks. And those rocks are owned by the United States. They have been loaned out to other countries for their scientists to use. We've given them as gifts. And there are space lawyers who argue that because the United States did this, and because nobody else complained about it, that because of that, we can mine asteroids and the moon.
In an episode called The Market is Run by Robots, we explore how machines are rewiring the investment world. I had the privilege of spending a day on the trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange with one of the people who knows it best.
The fact that they pay us to do things we like, how lucky are we, right? So, you want to go to the trading floor?
Go to the trading floor.
We begin at the New York Stock Exchange.
Thank you.
Where few are better equipped to show us around and talk about how this place has changed than this man.
Well, all right. I'm Ted Weisberg, and I'm the founder and president of Seaport Securities Corporation, 40-plus year member of the Stock Exchange.
If you've ever been to the trading floor, the first thing you might notice about now is just how quiet this is.
Trading used to be in five rooms with approximately the floor population, brokers, clerks, support people, maybe 5,000 people. Now, I mean, I'm just guessing, I don't know exactly, 700, 600. And all the equity trading has shrunk into what is called the main room, which was here when I started in 69. It used to be this room, and then behind us, the garage. But now all the trading is done here, and because so much of it's electronic, less people, and they don't need all the space. And even though it's quiet, there's plenty of trading going on, but computers don't talk, right?
It's not unique to this place. The world's largest trading floor, UBS in Stamford, Connecticut, is larger than a football field. It's also empty and up for sale. Theodore Weisberg is 77 years old. He started working for a brokerage at 15. In those days, he says he wasn't allowed to listen to radio news at work. Perhaps that's part of the culture shock, to go from there to an investment world where drones and cell phones gather real-time data, and the trading floor seems as much a TV studio as anything else.
The trading floor itself is not solid. It's like a basketball floor, because historically we spend our whole day on our feet walking around, and to avoid getting shin splints, you know, they had to give a floor that had a little give to it. So when all these computers, the fear was that the weight of the computers on the kiosk where the trading takes place was going to be so heavy that it would actually violate the floors. So what they did was they built this grid that you see above you, takes the weight off the trading floor to make sure that, I guess, we don't fall into the basement or the sub-basement. It's never quite happened. But the building itself is absolutely exquisite.
Upstairs in Seaport's office, I sit with my colleague Justin Baer, as Weisberg tells us more about how his world has changed. He's had this upstairs brokerage for decades, but Weisberg says he stayed on the floor until sometime after the crash of 08 and 09.
I was told 30 years ago to be careful as a person working on the floor because change was coming, but the fact is I had 30 good years waiting for the change. But when the change finally came, it was pretty dramatic and is dramatic. And at 77, which is how old I am now, I am in the process of reinventing myself. My big risk is that I'll run out of runway before I get this done, but I can't worry about that. We just try to stay viable and important to our customers.
It's not just the number of jobs that's changing, it's the kind of jobs too. Trading based on algorithms and the people, called quants, who build and use sophisticated statistical models, are taking over the investment world. We dive into what this means in the rest of the episode. For investors, jocks, there's even a crowdsourced hedge fund.
I'm Christopher Mims, a technology columnist at the Wall Street Journal.
In an episode called Get Ready for 3D Printed Everything, we explore the role of additive manufacturing in what's known as the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Today, it's mostly prototypes and plastic trinkets, but 3D printing is poised to produce everything from airline parts and auto bodies to sneaker soles and even food.
I think if you want to understand the future of manufacturing and just the future of stuff, like physical objects that we own, you have to think about it in terms of these transitions where we come up with a new material and a new manufacturing process. And we divide ancient history into like the Stone Age and the Bronze Age and the Iron Age, and then the invention of steel, which was huge in the previous century. Of course, the big transition was plastics.
We're looking at a Bakelite telephone. It's one of the first consumer objects to be mass-produced from plastic.
As electrification happened and telecommunication became mainstream, of course, you had to make the objects out of something cheap.
Today, the absolute cheapest way to make something is with injection-molded plastic.
So if you can compete on a cost basis and you can mass-manufacture, then you're good to go. Then you're going to go mainstream. And so that is the gold standard for 3D printing.
And a segment in that show stirred listeners up quite a bit. In it, we ask, what about printing with things that are alive?
I'm Jennifer Lewis, and I'm the Vice Professor of Biologically Inspired Engineering at Harvard University. And here we are in my lab on the campus of Harvard in Cambridge.
This lab 3D prints with human cells. It's called bioprinting. And that drumming sound is the printer.
We have been really pioneering this bioprinting approach that allows us to co-print simultaneously human cells, the extracellular matrix, which is the supporting structure containing proteins and waters that your cells reside in, and then these vascular architectures, because every cell needs to be within a few hundred microns of one of these blood vessels, because the blood vessels supply nutrients like oxygen that keeps the cells alive, and it carries away the waste products.
Everything they make here starts with real live cells. So the first step in this process is to grow a whole lot of them.
And we've got at least a million to a billion cells in a very small volume. And that is on the order of what you find in human tissues.
The tissue they're making here self-assembles or grows.
The first thing we have to do in our workflow, in our biofactory, if you will, is to create these cells so that we can create what we call biological inks that can then be printed on our multi-material bioprinter. So let's go over and check that out. So what you're hearing in the background is one of our bioprinters, and presently we're printing a kidney chip. Why this is important is we're using these to screen drugs and to test their safety and toxicity.
Billions of dollars are spent each year bringing new drugs to market.
So our idea in being able to print these three-dimensional tissues on chip is to create a phase zero that is in between animal models and human trials.
It could save drug makers time and money and help get therapies that work to market more quickly.
Hi, my name is Dr. Kimberly Homan, and I work as a research associate here at the Wyss Institute.
She shows me the incubator where the chips go after printing.
This is the media that's actually feeding those cells. You can see it drip. And then every few days we come in and change this and give them new, fresh food, basically. It's like feeding your fish at home. Yeah, so in this room, what we're seeing here is a confocal microscope, and it's beautiful sort of multicolor images. Each of these are little bits of kidney tissue, and the red and the yellow is all the vasculature tubes, right, that they need to survive. And green is another type of cell that we were looking to control. And you can even see, like here, see that yellow line of one touching the other? That means the vasculature between those two pieces of tissue actually talking.
Their long-term goal is to produce whole kidneys for people waiting for an organ transplant. Though, to be clear, that's a long way off. We get unbelievable support from dozens of reporters and editors, but none contributed to as many episodes this year as Christopher Mims. And it's thanks to a deep dive with him on brain implants that we met one of the world's first true cyborgs.
Emily Borgard, we're at Columbia Presbyterian, the locker room for the volunteer staff who are then going down into the ER to volunteer.
So what was your life like before you got the brain implant?
I was dropping down on the ground at unexpected times. I also wasn't remembering every day, and I was really living through other people because they were making sure that I was taking my medication, that I knew where I was, what was going on, and we were not sure if I was going to be able to go back to school because I could barely be left alone in a room for a half hour.
It's a pretty giant leap to connect the dots from then to now because, as we say, if a picture paints a thousand words, what I'm looking at is a very independent woman who volunteers in the emergency room of a New York City hospital sitting in front of me. So can you walk us through how you got from there to here?
Dr. Lawrence Hirsch told us about a study that was going on called NeuroPace, and it was a scary idea that they would cut into your head and put a device that was a computer into your head And it was a trial, so they didn't know how effective this was going to be, and I would be one of their lab rats. But at that point, we were desperate enough that that was what the next step was going to be. I was in college, but I couldn't tell you how the college experience was because it was really a day-to-day experience. And my parents were getting phone calls from my roommate saying, she's on the floor again. Or I was calling them saying I had major seizure activity. I couldn't go to class all day today. So that's not a way of living. At some point, we had to have a solution.
What was it like to get the implant?
Well, the day that we found out the surgery date, I was thrilled just in the fact that they accepted me for the trial study. Then also NBC News wanted to film the surgery, and I was thinking to myself, I'm going to have a gown on. Like, is the whole entire world going to be seeing me like this? There were mixed feelings there. And you can honestly see on the NBC piece, there's a point at which I break down. I'm with Mom, and she goes to hug me before they take me into the surgery room, and the floodgates open. And to this day, I can watch that piece and feel what that was like for both of us, because she was sitting there not knowing what the outcome was going to be. I was going in there just hoping for the best. And I was on the table and they were prepping me for anesthesia and I heard drills. And I was thinking, oh my God, what did I get myself into? And can they please give the anesthesia right away? Otherwise, you know, I'm strapped onto a table and I'm hearing these drills going. I couldn't have any preconceived ideas. It's kind of like if you go to the dentist, you have an idea of all those little annoying things that are going to happen. I had no idea what was about to happen. So I just went in there and said, okay, this is hopefully going to change my life.
The field that gave Emily her life back is known as neurotech. It combines neuroscience and the kind of hardware that goes into a smartphone. Today, most neurotech companies are focused on medical applications, but if you go back and listen to the whole episode, Christopher gets into the many other ways that Silicon Valley startups and even the Defense Department are hard at work on brain-computer interfaces. And finally, as the world population continues to urbanize, one of the great challenges we'll face is getting food into cities. An episode we call The Urban Indoor Future of Farming is my personal favorite from season one, and not just because there are baby goats. Whoever decided New Jersey is the Garden State didn't have this place in mind. In the flight path of Newark Airport, it's so loud, freight trains fade into the background. Then you step inside. It's not just the change of scenery and sound that's dramatic. The smell is radically different in here.
We don't use organic pesticides, organic herbicides, organic fungicides. We use zero.
David Rosenberg is the chief executive of AeroFarms.
The food is ready to eat without washing it. So we don't put chemicals on the plants, and so nothing touches the leaf structure.
But that's not why it smells like a forest.
Air in AeroFarms refers to aeroponics, so we aeroponically mist nutrition to the root structure. So there's a healthy oxygenation given the mist. Roots want oxygen, the leaves want CO2, so we also put in supplemental CO2 to the plants.
A very high-tech forest. Giant sheets of plants and lights tower overhead, and lifts are helping people harvest all the way up a dozen layers of these well-lit plants into the air.
We have thousands of sensors within this farm that are capturing information, and we're as much a big data company as anything else. We have plant biologists, plant physiologists, plant pathologists, molecular biologists, microbiologists, and those people also have a background in statistics, so we're able to look at this data and understand really how to stress a plant to get different outcomes.
It's safe to say I've never thought about what stresses a plant.
So we could influence vitamin A, B, C, D, antioxidants, again, just by stressing a plant.
So I asked Rosenberg to give an example.
You've heard, stand outside, get a little sun, increase your vitamin D. In a similar way, we could give different spectrum at different intensities, at different frequencies, or there are lots of other ways to stress a plant to maybe get it defensive, and it creates antioxidants, and you have high antioxidants kale.
He says they also use this to control for texture and taste. But one of the criticisms of this method is the energy cost and consumption of all this lighting.
From a photosynthesis standpoint, we look to see what spectrum at what intensity optimizes photosynthesis and what doesn't. And we're able to give the plants different spectrum, different intensities, and cut out wasteful spectrum. For example, yellow spectrum, which is the energy hog, there's very little yellow spectrum in here.
Back in the newsroom, I seek out some big picture perspective.
My name is Dixon DePommier. I'm an emeritus professor of public health and microbiology at Columbia University in the city of New York.
Otherwise known as the father of vertical farming.
We didn't call it vertical farming right away. We just called it indoor farming. And, of course, everybody knows how to do that. It's a greenhouse. But what if there's not enough room in a greenhouse to grow food for 7.3 billion people?
His story goes something like this. His students want to study rooftop farming as a way to feed the future population of New York City. It's meant to be a feel-good project.
Picked the island of Manhattan to narrow the scope of the study, which had a population, I think, at that point of 2.2 million people. And then we calculated, based on the New York City maps of actual footprints of buildings, building by building, with flat roofs that were non-commercial, how much space there actually was to grow food into New York. And, of course, 2.2 million people, they each consume about 1,200 calories a day. Rice is probably the most energetic crop per bite. And so they grew rice on the rooftops of New York City, and they could feed 2% with all the rooftops filled with rice farms.
He says that's based on one crop per year on an open rooftop. But before we go any further, can you grow rice on a rooftop?
Yes. So I can show you a building in Japan. It's called Persona 02.
As for those disappointed students, DePommier says he was looking at the Manhattan skyline when an idea hit him. What if urban vegetables were racked and stacked the same as urban people?
What about a building that's 30 stories tall and half of a New York City block and footprint? How many people could you feed then? Well, that was next year's project.
Vertical farming operations are cropping up all over the globe, but when they'll turn a profit, or what types of produce beyond salad greens will become sustainable products, remains to be seen. DePommier says the method often takes off out of a need, such as in Japan after the meltdown at the Fukushima nuclear plant in 2011.
In 1 hour, they lost 5% of their farmland. So the Japanese government said, who knows how to grow food in another way? And basically it turned out that they were already working on that at Chiba University, and then they just threw a lot of money at it. And the next thing you know, Toshiba and Panasonic and other companies were involved. And so it's growing food indoors on a large scale now. They're going to try to feed their whole country this way. Singapore has a similar phenomenon, and they have no space, basically. They have no land, but they're interested in food security. So this is how they get it.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. The show is produced by Laura Sim and Martha C. Daniel. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. We had help with the shows featured in this episode from The Wall Street Journal's Christopher Mims, Brian Baskin, Jeffrey Rogo, Justin Baer, Gregory Zuckerman, Adam Mann, Larry Root, Jennifer Hicks, and Mike Miller. Join us online for photos of some of the people and places we talk about here. Just search for the Future of Everything podcast on Facebook and Instagram. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong from the Newsroom in New York.
Oh, what? What's that? What is it? I knew that's what I was waiting for.